morning, la conversazione sarà in inglese con Ho Chun Yen. Abbiamo inaugurato ieri sera e stamattina appunto facciamo una chiacchierata informale per attraversare il lavoro, che è molto complesso. Siamo un gruppo ristretto, quindi sentitevi liberi di fare voi stessi domande. Good morning, Ho Chun Yen. I think it's important to understand a bit of the genealogy of the critical dictionary of Southeastern Asia. Maybe to start by telling where you come from in terms of education. I think it's very relevant for the whole project, and because of your studies, and maybe then how then you arrived to conceive this undertake that you carry on since 2012 now.
So, just to give a brief idea of my own biography, I guess. I mean, after graduating in visual arts, I did a master's in Southeast Asia studies. So, one of the most basic questions in Southeast Asia studies is, what is Southeast Asia? So in many ways, the critical dictionary is part of that, comes out of that question. But to answer that question, or to propose answers for that question using different means rather than the academic research means, I decided to do it as an art project. So maybe it's good to give a little bit of background on Southeast Asia as well. So so for those of you who are not
that was
familiar,
the next question.
Oh, so I can jump ahead of this. So for those of you who are not familiar, Southeast Asia includes countries like Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand, Laos, Vietnam. All of these countries are very different. Actually, all of these countries never share any language in common. They never had a religion in common. So I guess one way we can think about Europe is that at least perhaps the roots of Christianity kind of formed a certain kind of a link in how you imagine the universe. But in Southeast Asia, it's completely heterogeneous, completely different. Yeah. So from inside Southeast Asia, in the earlier part, from before the middle of the 20th century, nobody in Southeast Asia thought about themselves as being part of this one region. In fact, the word Southeast Asia didn't even exist before the 1940s. So the term Southeast Asia became common. It became more common probably in around, starting in 1943, which is in the middle of the Second World War. So the Allied forces created a strategic command center which they named Southeast Asian Command. And this was meant to free this region from Japanese occupation. So after the war, this term Southeast Asia started to circulate a little bit more. So after the Second World War, as we know, we were plunged into the Cold War. So American military and even the CIA started investing a lot of money in universities to create a Southeast Asian studies. So they funded Southeast Asian studies, and the main reason was one of the main reasons later on was going to be Vietnam, because the Americans thought that in order to win the war, which was not going well in Vietnam, they needed to understand the people in Vietnam through anthropology, through history, you know. So a lot of money went into the founding of these academic programs. So since then, the term gradually became more and more popular. So for me, in many ways, Southeast Asia is it's simultaneously real and unreal at the same time, because this idea of Southeast Asia is constructed not too long ago, but at the same time, maybe more than 50 years has passed since its construction. It has also begun to take on a certain reality of, you know, with time. So this was always what fascinated me the most with Southeast Asia, which is that it is simultaneously not real and real at the same time.
And going back to the idea of the studies, now that you have been mentioning the genealogy of how those studies in Southeast Asia has been also brought in by external forces, so to speak. Are those studies, did those studies became critical lately, let's say, to again deconstruct this idea of, or this notion of this term of Southeastern Asia, or they keep on accommodating and forming this identity?
Yeah. I think maybe starting from about 15, 20 years ago, within the academic discipline of Southeast Asia studies, these kinds of self-reflexive criticality began. And so for example, one of the most important Southeast Asia studies programs in the world is at Cornell. So usually in Southeast Asia studies, we call the scholars that come out of Cornell, the Cornell Mafia. So they are very important for constructing the basic frameworks of Southeast Asian studies. So the most well-known member of the Cornell Mafia is Benedict Anderson, who wrote the Imagine Communities, which was a very important critical text. So it was around Benedict Anderson's time when these kinds of deconstruction began. But the field is very uneven. There are also, I would say this is just maybe a small percentage of scholars who are thinking like that. Most other scholars still continue you know, working without necessarily engaging with these questions. So maybe I should also add, Southeast Asia Studies program in the university is very interesting in some sense, because it's actually a non-discipline in the university, because unlike medicine or law, you know exactly there's a fixed set of things that you are supposed to study and engage with. But Southeast Asia Studies is not defined by discipline, it is defined by area. So people in Southeast Asian Studies include historians, anthropologists, political scientists, economists, ecologists, you know, so it's completely multidisciplinary. And I think maybe this also had some kind of an impact on how I think about Southeast Asia.
I mean, the whole idea of the critical dictionary of Southeast Asia seems really to correspond to this polyphony of disciplines, of way of thinking. So maybe you can say, if you can tell something about how you got to the idea. We have been speaking in those days, and it is clear that it's always difficult to go back to an idea of origin for him when the project starts. And but still, I mean, maybe you can try to map a bit how the idea of the critical dictionary emerged, and maybe if you have influences in the way of for the to this methodology to emerge?
I think it was probably when I was doing my master's, at the time when I was doing my master's, when I thought that the question to what is Southeast Asia can perhaps be more interestingly addressed through art rather than through academic research. I mean, simply because, to put it in a more reductive way, like in the academy, you know, it is much more difficult to make speculations, whereas I guess within the field of arts, we are more free to do so. So, just this image of Southeast Asia as an object which exists and doesn't exist at the same time. Like if I had to write an essay to explain that, I think it would be impossible. So whereas using arts, it's somehow easier for me to propose this model. So I think this, in many ways, informs the eventual way in which the project took shape. So what we are showing here on this website is a film version of the Critical Dictionary of Southeast Asia, but it is actually edited in real time by algorithms. So the film is unstable and it's always changing. So for me, this was a possible way not to represent Southeast Asia, but to produce a model of Southeast Asia, to produce a model that is as unstable as that which it is a model of. So I think a lot of these ideas that I started thinking about as early as 2000, actually, when I was doing my master's in Southeast Asia, it was between 2003 to 2006. So already in those days, I, you know, was thinking about this question of Southeast Asia and how best to address it. But it was only around 2012 that I started actively trying to design this work.
And the idea of the dictionary then was how did you why a dictionary and why the English alphabet, which somehow again embrace
the colonial. So just to give also a quick explanation of the history of Singapore. So Singapore was colonized by the British from 1819. And colonization was very violently broken by Japanese by the Japanese occupation, and then Singapore, after the Japanese surrendered, Singapore was actually part of Malaysia, and in 1965 the Malaysians kicked Singapore out. So Singapore became independent only in 1965. And in Singapore, we all speak English as our main working language. So 70% of the population in Singapore are, like myself, ethnically Chinese. But the land, if we have to think about this concept of the indigenous people, we sometimes think, I think the Malay people would kind of qualify as the indigenous, but even this is a big question sometimes, because the Malay people were not the first to have arrived in Singapore. They had also in their own way colonized Singapore from an earlier ethnic group. So this question of origin and who the land belongs to is a super complicated one. So just to go back to your question of why English. So English for me is the natural language in which I think, probably I dream in English as well. Yeah. So for me, it's simply at some level a pragmatic choice. But my own attitudes to colonization is also that this British moment of colonization, for me, has become a real part of my history. So of course we today are very critical about colonization and a lot of its effects, but at the same time we cannot deny, you know, the long influence, the influence that the British culture had on us for more than a century. So I think this has also become part of our heritage. So, you know, that's why for English. And going to the question of the dictionary, it's interesting because when we think about a dictionary, we think about definitions. We have the idea that a dictionary is supposed to produce for you very fixed, stable, and true definitions. But I would say that actually a dictionary is anything but stable, because language is never fixed. Language is evolving and growing all the time. So actually, if we think about the most important dictionary in the English language, is the Oxford Dictionary. There are huge teams of people working every day up to now, you know, on the dictionary, because new words and new meanings are always appearing. For example, earlier we were talking about hashtags. So this word would only kind of make sense now. So actually a dictionary is something that is ever evolving and growing. So I think, you know, that in some sense fits with what I had in mind for this project. But maybe I should also mention that before the word dictionary, I also added the word critical. So this also creates a strange relationship. I think there are two senses of the word critical in English. Critical could mean one is very critical about something, which is in the sense of a critique or to criticize, right? But actually critical could also mean something of utmost importance. So I think I like both of these meanings at the same time. So hence a critical dictionary. But to be critical in the sense of critique is also to say that one has a certain position. You know, one takes a certain position. Only when you take a position you can be critical about something. So that also in some sense contradicts the notion of the dictionary as this one unquestionable source of authority. So I guess there's a little bit of these kinds of ambiguities and ambivalence, like in the title, which I wanted to work with. But finally, I was also very inspired by a critical dictionary, an earlier critical dictionary done in the early part of the 20th century by a French philosopher, Georges Bataille. So Bataille created actually a critical dictionary in a journal that he was edited called Documents. There were only 3 issues of the journal, so he didn't go very far. But in every issue of the journal, he had a critical dictionary. And the critical dictionary has always fascinated me a lot. So one of the most amusing terms in the dictionary is the big toe of the human body, our large toe. So Bataille had a definition of the big toe, and he says that the big toe is the most important part of the human body. So this is amazing and of course a very far out idea, because we usually think about, let's say, our brain as the most important part of the body, but Bataille reverses it completely to the big toe. And his reason for the big toe is that he says humans are defined by verticality. We are different from animals. We evolved from walking horizontally on all fours. So when we evolved, we became upright and vertical. And he says that without the big toe, we cannot stand upright. So the big toe is the most important definition of the human. So I think there's a certain logic of a reversal, which is operative in much of Bhatai's philosophical work. So this was kind of a big inspiration for me.
It's interesting I've been going through the World Dictionary to edit or to propose a first edit of this world text. And when you read the text, you always have the impression that it's not, it's written in a way that is not finished. And you really feel it while you read it. It always calls for an editorial approach. You feel it's written for not necessarily to be just read alone as a dictionary, but to be performed. So it's really a way of writing that I feel, I'm wondering now if this idea of the world text with the definition is really the right way to present it. Actually, I'm questioning my proposal to you. still, I mean, yesterday people seemed to react in a quite interesting way to the definition that we selected. But for me it's really important this idea of a dictionary that seems to call for a constant, active way of reading and interpreting. No, it's really written in that form, which I find fascinating, both as a way of writing and then as a way of reading, obviously. So it's dynamic in itself in its forms of the way it is written. Mm. And just as a disclaimer, we selected all the terms that are partially in the dictionary, and then we chose to expand the definition or to present the definition just of those terms that we thought that it might make sense also not just for Southeast Asia but also could resonate to use a term here also in South Tirol but in general in Europe. I mean, you don't have to comment on this if you want. Yes, please. If not, we just move maybe more into this work.
Yeah, but maybe we could talk about a couple of these terms, just sure. To give a sense of, just to give an example, but also to try to make sense of why we selected these terms now. Yeah. Maybe the easiest is to start with A, which is the first letter. So A for me is for altitudes, so high and low. So a little bit of a tribute to Bhatai's high and low, you know. But A is also for anarchism. So my interest has always been to look at societies that are organized, that are self-organized, that have, rather than to follow the model of a nation state. So A for altitudes and A for anarchism, for me in the dictionary, becomes a way to think about the relationship between altitudes and anarchism. So in Southeast Asia, there's a huge land mass, which actually comes out from the end of the Himalayan mountains. And this huge landmass cuts across at least 8 different countries, including Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, but also cuts across India and parts of China. And this landmass, today we refer to it as Zomia, as a term. And this landmass, just to give you the an idea of how big it is the size of the entire Europe. And this landmass has never been controlled by any of the nation states around it. because high altitudes form a kind of barrier to state power. So to phrase it another way, armies run out of breath when they have to climb very high up. So this huge landmass is populated by many people who escape from the states, such as ethnic minorities, guerrilla fighters who are fighting the states. So in Southeast Asia, there was a moment when the Golden Triangle was very well known, which is the heroin opium production. And the Golden Triangle is also in the Zomia area. So what I'm interested in is this relationship between geography and politics. So in the dictionary, a lot of the terms are related to, kind of brings together very things that we might not usually think together, such as geography and climate in relation to politics, for example. Yeah. So I only spoke about the high altitudes of Zomia. So maybe now I move to the low altitudes, so which is the sea level altitudes. So there's a sea called the Sulu Sea, which is bordered by, on top of the sea, is a small sea that is kind of contained by a few different countries, by three countries, by the Philippines, Indonesia, and Malaysia. And the Sulu Sea has always been full of pirates and slave raiders. So they capture people and sell them as slaves. But this slave industry became really popular after the Western colonialists arrived, because they required labor. So this is also very closely connected. And in this sea, it is completely uncontrollable by any nation states, because it is also, in Southeast Asia, we have many archipelagos, and it's easy to escape capture if you can escape into these archipelagos. So I also look at the very high and the very low as these spaces of anarchism. So just to give an example.
If you're curious about any specific term, just pick, and he is a storyteller, as you can clearly see. We could spend here days.
Yeah, I have given many lectures about the critical dictionary, and I always try to start from A to Z, but I never ever finish it.
Actually, yesterday there was the day of mother language.
Yeah.
And it was a very interesting discussion about all the dialects in our country.
Yeah. So I think
it's
very well. This was actually something Emmanuel spoke to me about as well, that somehow he saw this strange resonance between some of the concepts I was working on in this dictionary with the situation here. And this for me, in a sense, is one of the most interesting types of resonance. That is the things that you don't usually you won't think about Southeast Asia here, but yet, at the same time, it can communicate in these strange resonances. So we also have like a question, like multiple languages and multiple dialects in Southeast Asia. I mean, even in Singapore, we speak three languages, four languages. So, and we are constantly switching between language. So yesterday when he was giving the speech, I was very confused whether he was speaking Italian or German.
This is because of my bad German. You were
confused. That's the reason.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
No, I mean, this is exactly the point why I decided to invite you as soon as I saw the work in Sharjah last year in April. I had the experience of Art for Resonance as a VR, and I can't say I was aware of the history of Southeast Asia, but to me the work really spoke because I feel that it has a planetary relevance. I mean, it speaks to a lot of situation, to a lot of geographies, and that's why I thought it was important to invite you right away. And then again, you can project on it whatever you want, but what I feel was maybe one of the most important point of this work is really this capability to connect history with the future crisis, which means history of colonialism with the current ecological crisis, and I felt this was visualized in the VR. So there are those images, those objects, those landscape, those air conditioning machine. It's this mixture of nature, technology, climates that can be very difficult to speak about, maybe also to go back to your idea of what academia is supposed to do. And this experience for me was really this being immersed in something that is difficult to be articulated, but it can be just felt. And this was the you made the magic with this VR. And for me, I mean, if I have to think about resonance, the work, really, the VR experience, for me, it's it really corresponded to an idea of what an ideal exhibition would be. I mean, as a curator, I can't reach that, and I'm jealous, because you have been placing objects in a space that it's not in our disposal. But really, this is what it is. I mean, it's really, you move people through a film, obviously with no coordinates, and to objects that could be obviously, object that is difficult to place in an actual space. So there is the idea. I don't know if you ever thought about it as an exhibition, but for me, it was that.
But just to kind of go back a little bit to what you have just shared, I think the climate, the effects of climate, for example, on the imagination, I feel is something that has not really been adequately expressed. So for example, if we think about art history, art history talks about styles, talks about biographies, but surely climate, our geography, changes the very way we think and imagine. So this was also something I was always kind of curious about. So to think about history, I think we have to find a way to think about it as a total kind of ecology. And this goes back to what you mentioned earlier about our current planetary ecological crisis. So sometimes I think we don't necessarily have to make works that take on a kind of activist mode about these types of crises, but maybe the way that we deal with our subject can already encompass these kinds of ecological imagination. So, I mean, this was something I have been trying to do with the dictionary project. So this necessarily means that nature and culture, which in the Western academic tradition, I would say, or metaphysical tradition, is usually separated into two. And I would say this separation of nature and culture is in many ways the root of this crisis that we are experiencing now. So how to not think about this divide, or how to cross or traverse this divide is, I think, you know, for me an important kind of like task at this point in time.
Any question? Maybe if not, I just do last two questions.
Yeah.
Maybe one to go back to resonance as an idea. If you can just maybe connect, I mean, talk about it maybe in relationship with the material, which also, you know, belongs to a tradition of belongs to your way of thinking about class, about extraction processes, about politics. And this is the first one, and I'll get to the second one.
So yeah, so we should definitely talk about resonance, since the show is R for Resonance. So R for Resonance came out of my interest in gongs, so the musical instrument of the gongs. So actually, we can think about the Critical Dictionary of Southeast Asia as a collection of motifs, biographies, concepts, all of which are sort of small little threads or lines by which I am proposing a different way of weaving together the region known as Southeast Asia. So, and one common thing that can be found across Southeast Asia is the presence of bronze gongs. So this we can find in the Philippines, which is on the northern side of Southeast Asia, Thailand to the south, which is Indonesia. We can find it everywhere. So bronze gongs started appearing in Southeast Asia maybe around 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. It depends on who the particular scientist, so it's still being debated. But it appeared between what we call the late Bronze Age and early Iron Age of Southeast Asia. And traditionally in Southeast Asia, all musical instruments are made of two different types of materials. We have bamboo instruments and we have bronze instruments. So bamboo instruments are very popular because bamboo is everywhere in Southeast Asia. So and it's cheap, it's easy to manipulate, you can cut the bamboo easily, and bamboo is also hollow, so it creates it's acoustically very sonorous, so it's good to use it for instruments. But the problem with bamboo is that it decays very quickly in Southeast Asia because of the humidity. So just to give an idea of how all of these concepts are woven in the dictionary, under D in the dictionary is D for decay. Under H in the dictionary is H for humidity. So this already is folded in into thinking about B, which could be B for bamboo. Yeah. So then comes bronze instruments, and bronze persists in time because bronze instruments can resist humidity, so they can last a long time. But in order to make bronze instruments requires a labor and resource intensive process of casting bronze. So in other words, you need access in order to make bronze instruments. So at the same time, in the late Bronze and early Iron Age, when bronze instruments first appeared, is also the same moment in which we find traces of societies being stratified, meaning that you started to have class divisions. So it is only when you have class divisions that certain people in the societies have the resources to make other people work for them to produce bronze. So bronze comes together with class differences, I would say, in Southeast Asia 3,000 years
ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, these were the kind of research I was doing, you know, on the emergence of bronze gongs. And this was kind of what made me interested, which is that just by thinking about one single object like a bronze gong, you can unpack it into things that relate to the climate, to social and political organization. So actually, all of the court music in Southeast Asia are usually made with bronze instruments. So for example, in Indonesia, we have the gamelan. So every instrument in the gamelan is actually a gong, sort of a bronze gong. So whereas bamboo, flutes, these are more, let's say, the music of the tribes, you know, that are not organized by the courts. So, and of course, I am also very attracted to the sound of gongs. So when we experience a gong, we are not listening to the gong as we would listen to a melody, because we are feeling actually the vibrations of the gong through our whole body. So the way that I like to phrase it is that when we experience a gong, our entire body is transformed into a giant ear, because we are vibrating with these resonance. So this also explains why I decided to instead of G for gongs, I decided to put it under R for resonance. But maybe just a last point on the word resonance in relation to the bigger project of Critical Dictionary of Southeast Asia. So sometimes I think about a region, this question of regionalism, you know, about how different units, let's say now, since the 18th century, we have the nation state as the unit, can come together to form a union, let's say the European Union, which in many ways is a kind of a utopian idea of this common community. But throughout history, we have always seen that when such unions are formed, the relationship is never equal. There is always a hierarchy in these kinds of union. So maybe with the EU today, we can think about Germany, the Germans. But the Japanese, in early 20th century, they had this idea of creating a Pan-Asian community, which is called the Greater East Asian Co-Prosperity Sphere. Yeah. But of course, it was a utopian idea to form this Asian Union to decolonize. But at the same time, we all know it turned out very badly, because in order to free Asia from the colonizers, they became the colonizers. Right? So these unions are always unequal. So for me, thinking about Southeast Asia, if we were to think of Southeast Asia as a union, how can we think of a relationship that is completely horizontal rather than a vertical and hierarchical one? And for me, this horizontality is resonance. Verticality, I think about it as reason. So I would like to contrast reason with resonance. So reason, as we know, like from European history, let's say with the Enlightenment, reason was a kind of a utopian idea as well, but it became, as the rest of the world experienced European Enlightenment, it always came with violence and power, with colonization. So whereas resonance is a relationship in which every single body in the room can feel these vibrations, a certain kind of, I think Goethe has a novel, beautiful novel called Elective Affinity, So I think about these vibrations as this kind of elective affinity. We are not bound together by the laws of reason, but we feel this resonance between us. So I also start thinking about resonance as this other mode of organizing a community. So, is there anything I should add?
For me, it's all quite clear.
Yeah.
I would just add a last curiosity for me to close also the circle of thought. How your work and proposal are received back in the academic field, if at all? I mean,
yeah. I think I ran into my former professor from Southeast Asian Studies program, and I mean, he was a big fan of the work, but then he is also one of the more liberal thinkers in the academy. So the process of going back into the academia has been slow, but at the same time, I think it's been steady. And so like 2 weeks ago in Chiang Mai, I did a lecture about this project with a very well-known Thai historian and Southeast Asianist. So sometimes they don't quite know how to respond to it immediately, I have to say. You know, so I think it's also kind of mixed, you know. So I find it very hard to answer the question. I don't really know how it's received. So sometimes you hear good things, but people usually tell you their feedback only when it's positive, and if they hate it, they don't usually talk to you. So I think it's difficult to assess. But still, I think my own practice deals a lot with research, and I draw a lot from materials produced by other academics. So I would like to think that it's at least some kind of common ground for communication, and I definitely respect and value their thoughts and reactions. But at the same time, not every academic is like immediately interested in artistic kind of propositions. Yeah. So maybe let's talk about this in 10 years time. I have a better answer for that.
That's a good proposition. If you have any question or comment, if not, thank you, Tzu, again. And thank you.